Hello and welcome to Untouched, the podcast from the Centre for Visual Cultures at Royal Holloway, University of London. In this podcast series, we will be delving into the themes of touch, tangibility and intangibility in engagements with art on an everyday basis, on trips to galleries, in curatorial practice, in artistic creation and in academic research. We will be asking what it means to physically interact with visual culture, what we can get from non-visual engagements with art, how the pandemic has changed our approach to artistic interplay, and what happens when we encounter the intangible and the unknown. Today, I, Anna Price, will be talking to Royal Holloway Principal Julie Sanders on adaptation studies and the world of visual performance. Hello, Julie. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of the RHUL Centre for Visual Cultures podcast. First of all, please can I get you to introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about your background and your area of research.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Anna. So, yes, I'm the Principal of Royal Holloway, University of London, but I'm also Professor of English Literature and Drama, and my specialisms under that big heading are really in early modern literature. So I'm a 17th century specialist, and I do a lot of archival work that intersects with cultural geography and social history. And then I have a kind of second strand, I suppose, which is adaptation studies, which is something I've been interested in right through my sort of research and teaching career, actually.
Amazing. Oh, I'd love to talk to you sometime about the spatial and geo aspect of your research. I'm doing a little bit of that as well. But today we're going to be talking about visual culture in the form of theatre and performance, and also about adaptation and adapting literary texts, as you've mentioned. So I appreciate this is a very broad question, but are you able to briefly outline the cornerstones of adaptation studies as a discipline, just for the context of our listeners?
So it's really interesting. It made me reflect thinking about this podcast that I can recall when I first started working in the field. It wasn't a field. I mean, I think that's the thing to say. And it has become that. And there was a sort of sense that adaptation was a bit secondary. It was sort of less valuable in literary studies and related studies, actually. I think film and media studies started to change the profile quite dramatically, and how those different new emergent disciplines sort of bled back into, I think, traditional subjects like literature was really interesting. Now, actually, I would argue that it's a really profound field, and that in many ways for me, it's at the heart of thinking about literature and performance and media and communication more generally, because for me, adaptation is about engagement. It's about response over time and across cultures, across genres, across languages. And also really important for me, it's about positionality. I think adaptation is often about having a stance in some way on material and on the situations. And we can come back to that movement between words like adaptation and appropriation. But it's also, and I really think it's important to stress this, at least for me, it's also about pleasure. There's something visceral about our ability to make connections. And adaptation is all about making connections.
Amazing. Do you ever have the opportunity to adapt or adapt literary texts? I know I'm aware that you're on, I think, the board of a couple of cultural venues in the UK. And I'm just wondering if you're able to be involved in that process.
Yeah, so I'm not, I was stressed, I'm not a creative writer myself, but I do, particularly through being a trustee, get to really champion new writing and responses. And so I'm a trustee of both Shakespeare's Globe on London's Bankside. And now I have a really brand new theatre called Shakespeare's North Playhouse in Knowsley in Merseyside, which actually does much more than Shakespeare alone. But they have a great phrase about inspired by Shakespeare and bringing joy. So actually response texts are a really important thread of how they are making Shakespeare relevant to new communities and groups. So I get to watch that thinking process and creative process. And it's a really powerful one, actually, and really inspiring to see how Shakespeare can become less fearful in that space, I think particularly for young people. Because somehow it becomes malleable, it becomes shapeable, it becomes something that you can find a voice in and a point of entry yourself. And I always say, you know, often Shakespeare is not the first point of entry here. If you're thinking about something like Romeo and Juliet, then many people will have a kind of cultural knowledge. It might be from adverts, might be from certain kinds of films. other kinds of reference points, maybe song. And so the way you journey back to a Shakespearean text is very different to starting with Shakespeare and then seeing how it is adapted. So I think there's a changing sense of a kind of a web of connections now, rather than a kind of linear line of engagement.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but it makes a lot of sense, especially with the younger generations, I think, when Shakespeare in particular is embedded in our culture in so many ways. So I guess, are you saying that adaptation in this way makes these literary texts a little bit more accessible?
I think so. I mean, I think there is a kind of making relevant, but I think I'm particularly interested. So it's partly my bias, I suppose, in where adaptations are using well-known texts, canonical texts, be that Shakespeare or Dickens or Bronte or Austen, but actually it's part of a web of purposes that are in play that might be about thinking about contemporary issues, thinking about transcultural adaptation, different social or geographical or cultural context, political issues. So I, you know, that's an area that really interests me. There's a much straighter version of adaptation, or kind of BBC TV series. Yeah. But actually, even if you look at all of those different Austins across time, they do have moments of their own time, even if it's about casting, even if it's about choices, about actually who's performing in these roles. It's all part of the decision-making context, I think.
Do you find that these adaptations are then in conversation with each other? There's almost like an intertextuality in terms of adaptation.
Yeah, it's really interesting now. So, it has become a field, and therefore we've now got a few decades actually of adaptation studies. But I think what we've also got is a few decades of actually kind of longitudinal studies of reception studies. Mm-hmm. And so you can see how adaptations start to riff off of other adaptations. You yeah. probably don't see a Romeo and Juliet that isn't aware of Baz Luhrmann's film, actually. Yes. And Baz Luhrmann's film itself was riffing off of West Side Story. Yes. And so there's a lovely kind of, and actually what's at the forefront there and what's foregrounded, I think, moves around in all sorts of ways. There's a wonderful scholar called Thomas Leach, who writes a lot, who sort of talks about the Muppet Christmas Carol as the archetypal Dickens adaptation, which I really love because it has become, you know, a force in its own right, but it does take people on a journey to different kinds of Christmas carols too.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go back to a more traditional way of thinking about adaptation just for a minute, because one of the things that really fascinates me as well as an English literature student is the shift from kind of an individual internal vision of a text that's in the mind's eye, like a conceptual understanding, to then the physical realization on stage and then the collective experience of watching that as an audience. And I'm just wondering if this is something that's thought about and how this plays a part in adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, Suraj, I mean, theatre for me and live performance is such a powerful thing. And I suppose you could say, I mean, there's a scholar called MJ Kidney, who I work with a lot, and who's done a lot on adaptation studies. And she talks about the fact that actually every time you stage any play, it's an adaptation and interpretation of sorts. A process has gone on in rehearsal rooms, which, by the way, I think are the most fascinating kind of adaptive spaces. But I think if you've got, specific transmedia adaptations, a novel into a play, or a graphic novel into a film, or a play into musical, that's a different version of adaptation. But I think you've always got those new demands of the new medium, its genre, its conventions, its possibilities. And so live theatre, what it means to put bodies on space in stage with an audience, is a very particular set of circumstances, I think.
Absolutely. And just following straight on from that, thinking about physicality and how often is this kind of tangible link between audience and live performers considered?
So it's so strong, I think. And I suppose I am lucky to be in the sort of, it's often described as a kind of living laboratory, the Globe Theatre. But that's a space that's actually from the minute of its inception been doing sort of thinking about that. But I do think that here we are, having lived through what we've lived through over the last few years and seeing theatres go dark and not having those moments of collective congregation, I think it's made us, as a group of scholars working on live theatre, even more powerfully aware of it's a very particular set of transactions and agreements and sort of collective contract that goes on when you enter into a theatre space, whether that's an ad hoc site-specific space or a purpose-built commercial theatre, and like that collective, that congregation, and how that makes sense in the moment, but also how that collective is not a single monolith. You know, it doesn't just move as one wave, and we are individuals, and yet there is that group effect that happens. So I think audience studies and performance studies has just been fantastically important for me in thinking about how different moments of a play, how a visual tableau of a play, or a moment when something is said or done, or a moment when a certain prop is brought onto the stage, it kind of ripples out through that kind of living congregation that is the audience, is really important. And of course, very different to television and film in terms of directed attention, because your attention can move around in this visual context. You know, where does your eye rest at any given moment can be very particular, as can your sight lines. And there have been great studies done that have seen the different version of a play you get even sitting at different spaces in certain kinds of theatre venues. And of course, AR and VR are going to give us all sorts of new ways to play around with that, I think, and experiment with that in our research and our thinking.
Oh yeah, that's fascinating. I'm just thinking about building on what you just said and physical responses of an audience, and how being in the living space, in that space of the theatre in real life, how, I don't know if a physical response, you know, shivers or crying, is that more likely to happen in a live environment? I mean, I suppose you can still have that whilst watching television, but how is that in the live theatre space?
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I'm absolutely sure that gathering in a cinema space, you get certain amounts of crackle of an audience, but there is something different about having two groups of live performance going on that is, and there are just moments I can remember, and I think certain theatres, I suppose, in venues, deliberately try and amplify this or enhance that. So ones where we've got shared light, because I think where you've got shared light as an audience and a group of performers, that is a different kind of collective contract. Something different happens. But even so, even sitting in the dark, those moments of sort of shared cries. I mean, that language, interestingly, of contagion has been used around theatre for a very long time. We talk about infectious laughter, don't we? That because there's a ripple of laughter, actually we might respond to that. Of course, we now again think about that differently, thinking about pandemic. And of course, I work on a period when theatres did shut during plague time. Mm-hmm. And I found myself literally in the first week of the pandemic teaching a play that was all about closure of the theatres because of plague. And there we were trying to fathom our way through Zoom and whatever platforms we were jumping onto. So it was very much in my mind. But I have lovely memories, for example, of being in the Swan Theatre at Stratford-upon-Avon, where actors enter in sort of side ramps and come through the audience. So sometimes might be waiting right alongside you. And I've known people kind of almost start to breathe in rhythm with actors. Wow. or yelp or shriek. I've known the effect where, you know, if doors are opened at the back of the theatre and a cold air rushes in, you can really play with that sensory affect and how that both builds and separates members of the audience at different moments in the lifetime of that particular production.
Absolutely, I can absolutely see that. And, you know, just thinking a little bit more about these sensory experiences, I mean, on this podcast, we speak a lot about non-visual methods of approaching and researching visual art. We've talked about it, you know, being in a gallery space or studying an artwork and kind of getting that sensory experience. How is non-visual engagements with theatre considered?
So I think that the whole kind of sensory geographies of theatre is a really rich area of study at the moment, and really benefiting actually from that sort of network conversation in exactly where you're describing, with museums, galleries, so on, and some great projects going on at Royal Holloway in this space, which I'm really interested to learn from. But so one of the pieces of work that really inspired me a few years ago is by a scholar called Jonathan Gill Harris. And he's really writing about Macbeth in its first moments of performance in 1606. And so we're saying, what was it when there's lots of talk of kind of squibs and smells of brimstone, the witches, the cauldron, that we think probably would have been real little squibs, real little fireworks being set off at the edge of the stage. And how was that when that smell, you know, that olfactory scape starts to sort of take over an audience that is just months out of the deep psychological trauma and panic of the gunpowder plot. Mm-hmm. And how does that play out when you've actually got the smell of gunpowder and saltpeter milling around. And I sort of riffed on that and started, I've been doing a lot of thinking about artisanal craft. I'm really interested in the craft neighbourhoods of London and where the theatres are located. So if we take the Globe, which we've been talking about a bit here, you know, in Southwark, which in the late 16th and early 17th century was full of leather tanneries. And I'm really interested that so the audience going to a performance would have walked through and passed, and you cannot avoid the smell of leather tanneries. Anyone who's done travel in countries where they still exist as kind of open air spaces will know it's a pretty acrid stench. It's really fairly hard labour conditions that people were working under. So that would have been in the kind of air pollution of the moment. And then how does that affect you when you see a play that's about shoemakers who are literally working with leather on the stage? But I also think, what's it like if you're also a member of the audience? So I'm quite short. So I often think about how shortness, you know, we are up against the back of somebody who's got a leather waistcoat on, who might be a worker who's standing in the pit because that's all they can afford because they're an artisanal worker. How that starts to collapse these clear boundaries between the performance, everyday experience, what the audience member is bringing to make meaning. And I love those kind of points of contact zones, I suppose, points of intersection and interface that you get. And I think the non-visual sensory and haptic responses are so important in that. You know, what are the materialities of the theatre space, from the wood to the hazelnuts cracking underfoot because people have been eating them? So the sounds, the smells, and how that then all plays into how what might previously be thought of as a visual moment on the stage, actually it's this almost kind of 360 sensory encounter.
Absolutely. I'm wondering how that's manifested in contemporary times as well. It's a different experience, I think, going to the theatre now. I mean, often I'm thinking a little bit not about the Globe, but, you know, you're sat, you're quiet, there's the anticipation of waiting. It's a much more polite environment. So I don't know, how do you think that sensory aspect plays in into contemporary times?
Yeah, it's really interesting. And we're always starting to talk about different kind of codes of behaviour for different types of venues and different types of companies. Because obviously you've got companies like Punch Drunk and so on. You're really famous for sort of deep immersive experience. But I guess people going to a Punch Drunk performance know what they're opting into, that they're expecting that kind of full on. Whereas in certain kind of traditional West End venues or some of the sort of grand theatre royals that sit in all of our great, you know, civic spaces like Nottingham and Sunderland and so on, there's a different kind of contract and expectation. So, but I think some directors and companies are trying to sort of break that form a little bit, play with that. You know, you have great companies like, they're defunct now, and I sort of mourn their passing, Knee-High, who are a Cornwall-based company. But when you saw Knee-High perform in places like the Sunderland Theatre Royal, they would have, you know, people clambering over the audience, they would set things off, they would pass objects around, they would deliberately bring the lights up to try and play around with that expectation. And there's been a big debate just in recent weeks about noisy or badly behaved audiences, but who... I'm kind of interested in who decides the protocol, because actually that's a really Anglophone Western sense of kind of quiet theatre. Mm-hmm. If you go to watch theatre in Nigeria, for example, there's a really strong tradition of call and response.
Right.
So actually, as we're talking about a really multicultural London and a London where people have got multiple heritage, why is sitting quietly actually the right behaviour? And I think we've got to be prepared to ask some questions about our own practices here, actually, and what we deem to be norms.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm just going to circle back a little bit to thinking about digitization and perhaps about AI and the virtual world, and how watching pre-recorded theatre or recordings of previously live performances, you know, what are the physical effects going on here? You know, if there's a single person at home watching something that was once live, is there a distance?
It's a really interesting question. And I think there's no single answer to it, because I think sometimes when people talk about live, and of course, again, you can have the live streamed moment when you're watching in a cinema at the same time or even at home at the same time as people are watching it in a theatre somewhere. That's different to them watching the digital capture of the live stream performance. Yes. You've got these different layers. But I became really conscious, and I think we did become conscious. There were lots of lockdown parties of people watching things together. So in isolation and not, you know, having kind of Twitter threads of sort of live interpretation, almost as if they'd be gathering in the interval space. Mm-hmm. And you can start to choreograph some of that and think about that. And yeah, I would, and I love going to watch the NT lives and so on. I think it is democratizing, and I think it has made a difference in terms of just the number of things we can see. It's about access and inclusion, but it is different. It goes back to that thing about attention we were just touching on right at the start. Your gaze is directed and you can't get away from that. So if I was watching the Ivo van Hove review from a bridge, the Arthur Miller, with astonishing performances, but it went in for close-ups at various times. And I'm hungry to know what the other characters are doing, because I'm always really interested in the silent characters, the characters that are slightly at the back of the stage, who don't seem to have a lot in the kind of printed script, and yet in all kinds of ways are part of how we make meaning, partly because in the period I study, it's often the women that are standing there, or the boy actors playing the women, that are standing there not saying anything, but they're still there.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, presence matters, and that's part of that visual culture that clearly, you know, you're trying to unpack in all kinds of subtle ways in these podcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what you said there just made me think of quite a few years ago now, I watched Frankenstein at the cinema, but it was the live performance from the National Theatre. And I remember he was in a ball at the centre of the stage, and the camera was really zoomed in on him. And I remember thinking, well, what's happening on the rest of the stage? Yes. Like, what's the effect of having all that empty space around him? Yeah, that's so interesting. Do you think that as humans, we strive to watch these things together, and we want to know what other people are thinking? Do we desire and crave this collective experience in watching live performance?
I think it's interesting. I mean, I would say yes, wouldn't I? But that's because I've spent a lifetime of watching and going to theatre, and I do love that visceral, that physical effect. And I can absolutely feel that moment I stepped back out into the pit at the Globe for the first performance back after lockdown. I mean, you know, it was socially distanced. There were people had to sit on chairs under government rulings, but because it was outdoors, and just the thrill, just even then, even though you were watching actors who could not touch each other, who had actually spent hours and hours and hours in rehearsal working out how to put on a glove, to hand over a prop. And I'm not sure people saw some of that, but, you know, it's been really important to sort of capture some of that. Maybe for some people, though, actually, isolation is what they want. And I think giving the range of choices and options. But I was struck by how many of us, when that act of congregation or that possibility was sort of stripped away from us almost overnight, that March of 2020, that we tried to find other ways to have that communal conversation online, to feel that we were sharing something. So there's a lot of commitment to even people who were living in really different time zones. Let's watch this together.
Yeah.
And I found that really interesting. We were craving those ways of sharing, which I think is fascinating.
It is. It's that connection and kind of realizing the intangible links. It's like the networks of people across the world.
We didn't know quite how much we needed it till it was gone.
Yes. Indeed, absolutely. So we talk a lot about, obviously, at the Centre for Visual Cultures, visibility, and in this podcast, tangibility and touch and sensory experience. But I do also like to consider the flip side and think about the unseen and the intangibility, a little bit what we were talking about just then, and almost the inaccessible in these conversations on visual culture. And I'm just wondering how gaps in knowledge are dealt with in adapting plays for stage or screen.
It's really interesting, because I think adaptation studies it is itself really interesting, this issue of gaps and who fills in gaps and how do people fill in gaps, and that can depend on educational backgrounds, access and inclusion, but it also depends on all sorts of framings you do or don't put around a performance. I mean, I think it's really interesting looking at galleries at the moment, those that choose to put interpretive labels, those that absolutely don't, those that in a decolonizing context are offering explanation. They're all frames, aren't they? And how aware and not you are of those frames, or the absence of frames, is really interesting, I think. And I think as we try to think about the future of live theatre, which is under pressure, let's be totally honest about this. There's now there are a million one choices of how to access visual cultures of different kinds and different performance cultures. I also think cost of living, theatre is really hard to put on stage, and that's a difficult thing in itself. So how do we make it that people want to find for themselves that thrill of stepping across a threshold? Because it is a thrill. And I think finding, I mean, I use that phrase about pleasure at the beginning. I think that pleasure of realizing that you are making a connection and that it's yours to make, that it's the book you read or the conversation you had with your mate or that dance that you did that you're seeing playing out on stage. And I do a lot on global adaptations of Shakespeare, and it's, you know, was particularly fascinating for me when I was living and working in China, seeing some of the productions where I couldn't access any of the Mandarin. I'm really good at speaking Mandarin to five-year-olds, right? I'm not gonna, but I had the frame of the story so I could make some sense from the visuals. But the students were saying to me, oh, that's actually a reference to that Korean soap opera that we watch. And that's that. And actually that sharing, that cross-cultural conversation. So part of the gathering in a theatre is also the conversations around the edge of that. What we do on the way home, what we do in the intervals, what we do as we're milling around in spaces. And I almost think we underestimate that side edge part of it as part of the meaning making. And Shakespeare knew that, you know, all those epilogues at the end of the play about, you know, the wind and the rain, you're going back out into the world because you're carrying that meaning making. It's still going on. It's still part of the process. As you walk to a theatre, as you come back from a theatre, as you go to a cinema, as you walk back, as you go to a gallery, that's all part of the experience.
Absolutely. And I wonder, just to finish off, if you could speak a little bit more about adaptation and appropriation. I know you mentioned it at the start. I don't have a specific question, but I want to know more.
So when I did the first version of my book for the new Critical Idiom series on adaptation, it was really good. They wanted it to be adaptation and appropriation, and there'd be one chapter that would describe what is adaptation and one chapter that would describe what is appropriation. And I did do that, though. I'm really honest about the fact that they interlink all the time. But I think it goes back to that thing about having a political stance on the material. I think adaptation has been an amazing venue for marginalized communities, underrepresented voices, for challenge to play out in all kinds of ways. And I think we see the importance of that in all sorts of response material to the canon, which is itself a shifting beast, of course. But that is just endlessly rich and textured possibility for me.
Amazing. And I have a few quick fire questions to round off with. So what is your favorite piece of visual culture that you've worked directly on or been involved with?
It's just so hard to choose something. But I'll say it was acting as a student, actually, in a production of Taming of the Shrew, partly because I got to work with some people who have gone on to be just brilliant directors and actors, and just being part of a process where you are thinking about what it means for you. And I was a pretty silent character. I was Bianca. So it really did make me think about those characters that are seen and yet silent.
Yeah. Wow. And what is your favorite piece of visual culture in the world, so outside of your whatever?
In the world. I'm going to choose a space, and I'm going to choose the Piazza San Marco in Venice, because it feels to me like it's a bit of living theatre, and it's meant a lot to me over the years. I went there as a student, and as an Erasmus student. So.
Oh, amazing. I love that idea of a living space, of real world performance. Amazing. And what does interacting with art mean to you?
Oh, it's everything, really. And I've realized that the way I ground myself when stuff is difficult, and we're all feeling a bit overwhelmed in different ways at the moment. The joy of having access to amazing cultural venues is something I never, ever want to take for granted.
Amazing. And one very last thing, is there anything that you'd like to promote or make our listeners aware of with regards to your work or any projects that you're on at the moment?
I hope this has given people a little bit of flavour to think a bit more about adaptation and to get involved. And I'd really urge people to think about translation as a really rich area at the moment. I think there's some exciting stuff coming.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I will let you move on to your next thing. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. And look forward to meeting you properly soon.
you so much for listening to this episode of Untouched. All the information you need to find out more about us, the Centre for Visual Cultures, is linked in the episode notes. If you have any thoughts or questions on what we've discussed today, email us at centreforvisualcultures@rhul.ac.uk or tweet us at @rhul_CVC. This podcast is produced by the Royal Holloway Centre for Visual Cultures, located in the Languages, Literatures and Cultures Department at Royal Holloway. Edited by myself, Anna, with music by Gaspar Senna. See you next time.